Joseph versus the Board of Regents. Okay, Ms. Wheeler. Ms. Wheeler.
Chief Judge Pryor, may it please the court, I represent Michelle Joseph on this appeal. We are appealing the resolution of both her claims of discrimination in terms and conditions of employment through the disparate resources provided to her and her team, and also the summary judgment decision on her retaliatory termination under both Title VII and Title IX. I'm not going to address the preclusion question because you will focus on that in the Crowther appeal. And in this case, Georgia Tech has conceded that Joseph can proceed under both Title IX and Title VII on both of her claims. So I don't, unless you have questions for me,
well, Georgia Tech can concede that all at once. We've got to get the law right. That doesn't mean I'm going to concede it. I mean, if Title VII provides the exclusive remedy for sex discrimination in employment, where the sex discrimination is about the sex of the employee, if that's the exclusive remedy, then, you know, whether Georgia Tech would concede that Title IX provides that remedy as well is neither here nor there to me. That's just not going to be correct as a matter of law.
But I think it's wise to focus on those things for which, outside of what we're going to be talking about in the next oral argument.
I would say we could rest on our brief. We definitely
that's fine.
That in our brief.
Yeah, that's fine.
Frankly,
but I don't want you to take away from that we might not decide that differently depending on how the next case is argued.
Totally understand. Focusing on the disparity in resources, mm-hmm. which also presents a legal question, procedurally it's important to remember that the district court dismissed one of the claims on this preclusion ground, but analyzed it then under the other statute. We think the same standards apply under either statute, but focusing on the Title VII claim, I think that the Muldrow decision really is going to necessitate that this be remanded for the district court to consider the claim under the proper
statute. But why if there's a causation problem, why would we get to that point? So let's assume you're right on the conditions part. But as I understand it, the district court also made a determination, and a legal one, that but for your client's sex, there still would have been the same diminished resources given to the women's basketball team. My first question is, did I mischaracterize the district court's decision?
I think the court certainly said that.
Okay. My second question is this. Under Bostock, which you guys dispute, it seems to me that Bostock is at pains to say that the question is a but-for one. And the counterfactual given by both the district court and the board here is this. If the coach was a men's coach, everyone seems to agree that the women's team still would have gotten far less than it should have than the men's team. And if that's the case, then how but-for sex, or because of sex, or on the basis of sex, can we say that the what happened, the diminishment of resources, was caused by the sex of the coach?
So your hypothetical is if Coach Joseph were a man coaching the women's team.
Well, I wish I was that original, but it's the hypothetical of both the district court and the board here. But yes, that's what my hypothetical.
Yeah, that's the hypothetical.
And again, the argument would be a little different under Title IX and Title VII.
Just take Title VII. We're going to put in Title IX off the books right now.
Under Title VII, we would say, just think of it very simply, a woman coach, a man coach. The woman gets much inferior resources for all parts of.
But the hypothetical is, the hypothetical is that regardless of whether it's the coach is a male or a female, the coach of the women's team, the resource disparity exists. Doesn't that foreclose the Title VII claim?
That's my question.
Okay.
Said much better.
I mean, that's. I just don't see how it could be anything other than for barring the claim.
Then
it's not because of the employees, that is, the coach's sex. It may be because of the sex of the players.
Correct.
But that may be a Title IX inquiry. We can get to that in a moment. But at least as to Title VII, that seems to foreclose the claim.
And we think even under Title VII that there is this associational theory.
But even if the associational theory, as I understand Bostock and our case law, it still has to be but for. In other words, I think the example that's used by both the district court and the parties here is, and based on our case law, is marriage. So if on a same-sex marriage, if I am discriminated against because I am in a same-sex marriage, it is because of my sex. In other words, if I was a woman, I would not be discriminated against because of a same-sex marriage. Same thing with interracial marriage. If I am married to someone of a different race than myself, I am discriminated against because of my race. Because if I was a different race, I would not be discriminated against.
Yeah, in other words, if I were married to someone of an opposite race, I'm discriminated against because I'm of the opposite race.
I understand that's what many of the cases are about, interracial marriage, homosexual.
That's what the association cases are about.
And yet the language is broader than that. It says any type of association, and there are certainly cases, for example...
I just don't see how under the statute, though, you can bring a third party. Essentially what you're asking is I can bring a third party discrimination. My team was discriminated against, so I can bring a claim on their behalf, and I just don't see how either the statute or standing principles or really anything gets us to there.
Not on their behalf, but that the discrimination against me is because of my association with this disfavored group. So that in the First Circuit decision, in that whole...
But it's not because of your sex.
Because the counterfactual about the men's coach plays in. In other words, if you put in a man there, the same discrimination. So it's not because of the association, because of your sex, it's because, for whatever reason, the university has decided to underfund the program. Maybe we can move on to the retaliation, the Title VII.
I was going to suggest that we move on to Title IX, though.
Okay.
Because it does seem to me that if your claim is we were being discriminated against in the women's program, and that there's an allegation here about disparity of salaries, Joseph's salaries versus the men's head basketball coach salaries, that this is the Title IX claim here is dismissed. It's not summary judgment. It's dismissed at the pleading stage. I do wonder whether a claim about that is not a Title VII claim, not an employee because of her sex, but it's instead about the program and disparities of resources where there's even an allegation about lower salary for this particular coach, whether that needs to go back for further development and that it was wrong to dismiss that at least at the pleading stage.
Well, absolutely. It would be wrong to dismiss it at the summary judgment stage.
But it wasn't dismissed at the summary judgment stage. And I can't possibly evaluate that without an evidentiary record.
The claim of disparity in resources included disparities in the quality of the locker room, the salaries for assistant coaches, the travel budget.
Yeah, I don't know. A lot of those things don't seem to have any bearing on the particular plaintiff, but insofar as the complaint notes the difference in her salary versus the men's head basketball coach salaries, then it does seem to me that at least it makes it specific as to her in a way that may have injured her. I mean, one of the things that Georgia Tech says about this is, well, there's no emotional damages recoverable here. That I think that's right. But I'm not sure that the complaint would not entitle the coach to some form of relief that at the pleading stage it's too quick to dismiss. You understand my point?
I do, and I agree. The disparity in the extra stipend for doing the radio and TV shows was $800,000 for Coach Passner, zero for Coach Joseph. So that I think even if Cummings is considered as limiting the available relief, we are way beyond emotional distress. We have what would be traditionally viewed as actual damages that would be available in a
court. Let's go to a retaliation.
Can I ask one other follow-up question
sure.
on that?
Sure. On the title, so with regard to a Title IX discrimination claim, this is just a question I'm asking you based on your expertise in this area. Has the Supreme Court or this court ever held that there is an implied right of action for a what I call a traditional or a straight Title IX discrimination claim for an employee?
No, that's why it's an open question that you're going to be addressing even more.
Well, the question that we're addressing is a little different than it. It might implicate that, but a little different. But I just want to know, if in your expertise, if you've ever seen in a published case from the Supreme Court or our court where we've implied a cause of action in a Title IX just for discrimination, not retaliation. I know what Jackson says.
Well, but yes, I think actually that the North Haven case said that. That was a discrimination case, not retaliation. It said Title IX extends to employees. The implied right of action in canon applies to employees, not just students. So I'm not sure why it's considered still an open question. Our pretext argument on the retaliation claim, it's a pretty traditional argument that the district court ignored evidence, drew inferences in favor of the defendant. I would highlight, as I know this court often does, that the suspicious timing that we discussed in our briefs about how the investigation started and the rapidity with which Joseph was fired at the end of it, suggest pretext, but we have much more than that. We have evidence that a jury could have thought that Stansbury did not honestly believe, based on the investigative report, that Joseph was an abusive coach.
No.
And then we have a lot of pieces of evidence about the way that...
How could you not believe that based on the report?
Do you want to...
I'm sorry.
How could you not believe that based on the report?
That she's an abusive coach?
Yeah.
Because he conceded throughout his deposition that he really didn't know who heard this, how many people were talking about these remarks.
So he can...
Especially what the context was.
He conceded that could have made it all up about the athletes coming to HR, about the letter, about the page and a half of vulgar terms that she called her players?
He did not concede that anyone made anything up.
What I didn't think that either, but...
No, but what he said was, I don't know if 10 people are referring to one incident, if everybody's talking about one thing they heard about.
Yeah, but we don't retry that from a trial stage at that time. What we determine is if there's any evidence that the university didn't believe that, correct?
That's what I'm talking about.
Right. What's the genuine issue of material fact that the university did not believe that?
Well, we think all the little pieces that suggest this entire investigation was set up to generate a reason to justify her termination, that it was launched based on a letter that said nothing about abusive coaching. It was during the investigation, Durham said he wants to use the letter to negotiate Joseph out of here. And then once the investigator presented his oral summary of what he is finding before he had interviewed Joseph, Durham said, I think we have enough. And when asked what that meant, said we have enough evidence to justify disciplinary action.
Well, that doesn't indicate you're biased. It just indicates that you believe the evidence, which is the absence of bias.
A jury could believe, though, I think, that all of these bits and pieces undermine good faith of that investigation.
So a jury could find that the university didn't believe any of this. And when the university said that program is rife with problems, my goodness, look at what she's called the women who are on those on that team. The jury could find the university didn't believe any of it. I thought she admitted she'd used that language and just said, what the hey, that's what coaches do.
She said she didn't use that language in a way that was abusive and targeting individuals.
Oh, she said, sweetheart, you're a prostitute, and your mother's a prostitute, and all this, I mean.
She never admitted saying that, absolutely not.
All right, what did she admit saying? She did admit saying some language because she said coaches use that kind of language.
She conceded that she would say that was an effing bad play or an effing stupid play, but that she was never saying that an individual was effing stupid or effing.
Well, if we're using letters, did she ever call any of the players a B?
No. The way she used that term was to say they're going to think we're playing like peas, or they'll think we're peas.
What about effing stupid or effing idiot?
I just said she didn't call people that. She said plays were that.
Plays?
The play. You made a mistake on the court. That was an effing stupid play. What are we doing?
So your case is based upon the report being false all the way through. And a jury could believe the entire thing was false.
That Mr. Stansbury did not in good faith believe that she was an abusive coach. Look, in September of 2018, Mr. Stansbury had said to her agent, we know she's aggressive, but coaching is coaching, and I'm not going to be hung up on that. In his deposition, he said, yes, many coaches use vulgar terms. I don't know the context of any of these in this report. And that's what we think a jury could have looked at altogether, not just the report or not just the timing, but the combination of evidence which the court did not review in a favorable light. My time is more than up.
Yeah, you've saved 3 minutes. Ms. Poole.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Courtney Poole on behalf of the University System of Georgia. I do have here with me today Tanya Ferranzo with the Athletic Association. Your Honors, obviously we understand this case falls into two separate buckets. We've got the retaliation claims predicated on Ms. Joseph's termination. We have the sex discrimination claims predicated on the resource allocations for the women's team. In reality, though, this is a very simple case. It rises and falls at the summary judgment standard, and Ms. Joseph doesn't have any evidence of any retaliatory or discriminatory intent. I want to address a couple of things that just came up in Ms. Wheeler's argument. First off, Georgia Tech does not concede that Title VII does not preclude Title IX. The question is much more nuanced, and I will leave that to Mr. Petrani to address in the next argument.
That we should, insofar as anything in the complaint is outside of Title VII in terms of a discrimination claim, that we should hold that there's no implied right of action for a sex discrimination claim under Title IX, apart from retaliation.
Sure, Your Honor. I think that it is. I don't believe that there has been a decision from this court or from the U.S. court that has said an employee may maintain a private right of action based on associational discrimination under Title IX. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely, I don't think that case is
Let's say I read this complaint, and I think part of it at least alleges that the coach complained that about discrimination, about that there was a disparity in resources and that at least some of the resources involved her own salary, okay? And that's because it was the women's program, not because of her sex. It would have been the same regardless of whether she was a male coach or a female coach. So it's out, let's say it's outside of Title VII, okay? Assume for the sake of my hypothetical. But it appears to be something that looks like a Title IX claim. What do you say about that?
I say that Title IX is a much different context from a general employment context, which is they're trying to pull all of these employment right. ideas into this case. Title IX regulations themselves say you do not have to give the same resources to the men's and women's teams of the same sport. Title IX asks whether the men's and women's teams as a whole, not teams, programs as a whole, are treated discriminatory.
Well, yeah, but she alleges they're not treated the same and that it affects her in an individual and personal way. That is, she gets a lower salary, okay? So she has standing, right? But that's different from whether she has a right of action for Title IX sex discrimination that's outside of a Title VII claim.
Sure.
You understand?
Yes.
What would we say about that?
I would say that that question hasn't squarely been presented to the court.
I know. How because it hasn't been, what should we do about it?
I mean, in this case, I take your point that the Title IX claim was dismissed at the motion to dismiss phase. However, yep. an identical claim was allowed to proceed under Title VII all the way through discovery. So we do
that insofar as it. Yeah, but the problem with it was the problem with that claim was it wasn't about her sex. Right.
Correct, Your Honor,
in my hypothetical, it is about the Title IX problem. It is about the treating the women's basketball program, in a disparate way.
I want to make sure I understand the question appropriately, Your Honor. Are you asking a Title IX claim predicated on Ms. Joseph's sex?
No. Nope.
Okay. A Title IX claim predicated on the fact that she coaches women?
Yep.
Same claim could be brought by Mark Joseph.
Right.
Right? Okay. So I don't think that claim does exist.
Mm-hmm. Why?
I have not seen any case, any court.
Because the statute itself doesn't create the right of action. And we shouldn't imply it?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no need to extend this judicially created private right of action to this type of associational discrimination. It's not at all clear in the text. I think the one thing that is clear are regulations.
Can I jump in here? Because you seemed to suggest earlier that this had never really been brought, really isn't in this case. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that to the extent that the Joseph litigation has incorporated the arguments from the Crowther litigation that we're about to hear from, the Crowther litigation seems to very much bring this up. In other words, part of the argument for why one is the other is that these others don't exist. No one's ever recognized it and it doesn't exist. So its existence really does seem to be part of the larger argument about does Title VII sort of occupy the field in federal employment litigation versus not? I mean, the existence of it is part of that inquiry, is it not?
I think that is a question sort of circling both of these cases.
I agree.
It's a question of whether there's this head-on preclusion issue where does Title VII only preclude those claims for which you could pursue a Title VII action? Or does Title VII occupy the field in this way?
Or even more fundamental than that, and we'll get to this with your colleague, but is there a preclusion at all where something doesn't exist? In other words, why engage in a preclusion analysis for that which does not exist?
I think that is a fair question, and there is no reason to read that claim.
Why chase ghosts, in other words?
Exactly, Your Honor.
Well, preclusion could be a conclusion that you apply to the fact that it hasn't been implied yet. You shouldn't imply it, therefore it's precluded. The reason it doesn't exist is that Title VII does. I mean, I doubt, given what Supreme Court's view of the need to create remedies has changed considerably.
Yes.
But at one time, at least, the primary restraint on the Supreme Court creating remedies in Title IX or a statute like Title IX would be that you already had something somewhere else.
Correct. Correct.
And it was carefully thought out a few months apart, or a year or so, and there are all kinds of administrative restraints and remedies and blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
So I asked a question of your opposing counsel about, and this is the last that I'll ask about the implied right of action question, but your opposing counsel asked, has the Supreme Court or this court ever recognized a what I'll call a straight or traditional employment discrimination claim in Title IX? And the answer I got was New Haven versus Bell. And I guess my question is, do you see Bell as implying a straight or traditional discrimination claim?
I do apologize. I will have to look at that case one more time. But I believe what Bell said was that Title IX extends to employees, not that there's a private right of action for them.
I think that's right. I think what it did was there was an administrative proceeding that had been created, and it was a question of administrative law of whether under Chevron we could, or pre-Chevron principles, we could apply a remedy in the administrative context, not that it created a private right of action. That seems to be my understanding of Bell.
I believe that is correct.
Okay.
And so there's no need to go beyond what those cases have already said. There's no need to... And particularly here, where it's not just a straight sex discrimination, it's also this associational, it's one more hurdle
right.
that she sort of has to get into. It would be a further expansion, and we just don't need to go there. And beyond that, just to your point, Chief Judge Pryor, there is an enormous evidentiary record in this case. So even if there were this cause of action out there, Ms. Joseph cannot prevail. She hasn't shown the type of compensable harm. She hasn't shown any.
No, the problem with that is, I don't think that's your best avenue for victory. The problem with that is, this was at the motion to dismiss stage, and I don't care what the evidence was because she hasn't had the opportunity to present evidence. And one of your arguments is, well, she's not entitled to any emotional damages. That may be. But if that claim exists, and I'm doubting it does.
I think it does not. So yeah. I would like to move on to the retaliation claim. There is no reason that any jury could ever disbelieve why she was fired.
Can you break it down then, since we have some time and we went over time with your opposing counsel? So as I read her brief, as summarizing the evidence,
yes, that's a warning.
There's three ways to look at the evidence. There's three ways to imply the evidence such that it creates a genuine issue of material fact on the Jackson retaliation claim. The first is that the athletic director was going to fire her before the investigation started. Secondly, that the investigation was not independent because one of the people she was complaining about, Aiken, was involved with it. So it was a sort of a sham investigation. There was a plant in there. And third, that the athletic director did not honestly believe the Littler report, which was sort of the focus of Judge Carnes' questions at the end. So if you can go through those three and show me why there is no genuine issue of material fact on those three things,
yes,
that would be helpful for me.
Yes, sir, absolutely. So to the first point, that the investigation was illegitimate from the start, Ms. Joseph's recitation of the facts there omits large swaths of the record. The women's basketball staff had been complaining to HR business professionals about Ms. Joseph in late January. Students were complaining about her to the general counsel in late January. By February 7th, which is actually the day before Ms. Joseph submits this long, detailed complaint about discrimination, the president says to Mr. Sansbury, as you know, we have a lot of issues in women's basketball, and I'd like you to look into it. And so then the following Monday, they get a letter that purports to be from a parent. I take their point that it's unsigned, but it says that this is from a parent of a student at your institution. My daughter is miserable, and I'm going to come get her and take her out of your school.
What about the path forward text to the athletic director?
That,
or from the athletic director.
Yeah, the path forward text was in response to his deputy athletic director had just said, I have to resign because I cannot work with Michelle Joseph any longer for my own mental well-being. The path forward is simply, it is a single comment saying, I'm a manager, I have a very difficult situation, I'm working on it.
Could a jury imply that, and which is what the argument your opposing counsel makes, could the jury imply that path forward was, we're setting in motion an avenue to fire her, and we're working on that now.
I think that would be an incredibly tortured reading of that text. I think even if a jury could believe that's evidence that he wanted to get rid of her, it's not illegal to want to fire someone who is causing you a lot of trouble. Like, your AD wants to resign, her athletes are complaining, her staff members are complaining. It's only illegal to want to fire someone because of protected conduct. That text was sent, again, many days before her February 8th complaint.
But after the November letter, right?
The November letter, which doesn't actually say anything. The November letter just says, we think that...
Well, it mentions Title IX and Title VII, doesn't it?
It does, but there's no substance there, Your Honor. When we talk about protected conduct and these types of complaints, they have to be objectively and subjectively reasonable. There's no clue what she's actually complaining about in the November letter. You can't just insulate yourself by citing these statutes. And so Mr. Stansbury's text, I'm working on a path forward, it's not indicative of a retaliatory intent. That's what she has to show. She doesn't have that. And I do want to move on to, you know, the next part about the investigation being unfairly conducted, something of that nature. I think the best evidence on this is to look at the investigator's testimony, where he said, no one told me who to interview. No one was telling me what to put in my report. Nobody told me what to do. Jolene Aiken was there basically to coordinate logistics. Someone had to do it.
She did suggest some witnesses, though, didn't she?
I think about four names. I think Mr. Hoffman, the investigator, talked to some of those people. He did include a note in his report that, yeah, I talked to them. That's not the basis of my report. My report is focused on the experience of this team. And then, so that takes me to our last point, which is, you know, did Mr. Stansbury believe this? Of course he believed it. He just watched two players quit. He knew that it was true.
In the middle of the season.
In the middle of the season, two games left. He's standing in a room with them, and he mentioned it in his deposition.
You don't mean middle, unless you got a four-game season. I saw that in your brief. Yeah, that doesn't work.
In the midst of the season.
That's my fault, not yours.
Yes, so absolutely. So the idea that, oh, he didn't know the context, or it doesn't say exactly who said what, it doesn't matter who said what. When you have a report that says every player interviewed did not want to play for her or questioned whether she should be the coach, you don't have a coach. I see my time is up, Your Honors. I thank you.
Okay. Ms. Wheeler, you saved 3 minutes.
So the November letter was not as vague as my opposing counsel suggests. It definitely refers to discrimination in all the terms and conditions of employment that we've mentioned. It also came on the heels of several years that Michelle Joseph had been complaining about these very issues. So there was no question that that letter was protected conduct. The text about the path forward, even though it's a few days before her complaint and the decision to investigate her, in our view, could be seen by the jury as evidence of a retaliatory intent in dealing with her. There is also evidence in the record that Stansbury, and our focus is on him as a decision maker, not the university as a whole, but Stansbury, according to those around him, was tired, he was annoyed, he was very frustrated with Joseph. The district court looked at that and said, yeah, that's why they launched an investigation of her, which seems to support the possibility that a jury could think this was a retaliatory investigation triggered by her complaint as much as by these other things going on. GT's counsel says, well, but look at all the things that were going on. But don't. Look at what Stansbury knew on February 11. Yes, the president had said on February 7th that he ought to look into all these complaints. When we deposed him, Stansbury said, I don't know what he was talking about. I didn't do anything. I really don't know what he meant, and I certainly didn't do that. So what did he know on February 11 that Michelle Joseph had complained? And he had this letter that said parents were upset because the team and other coaches had called Francesca Pond negative. This is not abusive coaching. So when opposing counsel suggests there's no evidence of retaliatory intent, the point that Stansberry is angry because she's been making complaints about resources. He's tired of that. Roundtree's tired of that. So Stansberry's going to find a way forward, which might be to get rid of Joseph. And then 3 days after getting her complaint, launches this investigation. During the investigation, Durham says, before they even interviewed Joseph, I think we have enough. We have all we're going to need. And then when the draft was presented, she said, oh, it's not as compelling as I had hoped. Was Aiken really that uninvolved in this investigation? She sent a text message to Francesca Pond and Kira asking if they could come up with any better examples of abusive treatment, said, maybe think about a Tuesday after at practice after you lost a game over the weekend. If that's not coaching witnesses to present information to the investigator to help reach the negative result that they wanted, whether it is or not, our point is simply a jury could have concluded that there was a lot going on behind this investigation that suggests it was designed and implemented to get rid of Joseph because she had been complaining for a long time about resources. My time is up. I wanted to say one thing, but on the question about the North Haven, it's true that was at an administrative stage, but then in Jackson, when the court recognized the claim of the male coach, I don't see anything that limits that to retaliation. It could be any kind of discrimination based on that.
Okay, we'll be asking about that in the next argument. Ms. Wheeler, thank you. Let's hear the crowd.